So I was guest preaching last week, which is weird. It's like going to Christmas at somebody else's house. The songs are similar, the food's the same, but it's not the same. And I got up in their first service to do my lesson, and I realized that I had not brought my phone, my watch. There was no clock at the back of the auditorium. And I was calm, I was cool, I mean, you know. And but inside, I'm panicking. It's white hot panic. I'm like, I think this sermon is 30 minutes, but if it's not, I'm going to be in trouble. In nervousness, I mentioned this, and I said, there's no clock at the back of the auditorium, which reminds me of that church that had a clock. This is a true story. That had a clock at the back of the auditorium, and underneath it, a sign that said, "Remember Lot's wife." Thank you. Where were you last week, okay? Because they all looked at me, they're like, "Lot's wife." Don't look back. Okay, that's for some of you, not as, okay. And so I just realized something this is a special place. You guys know me and you know how to take me and you love me anyways. You know, that's what's cool about this. But there is a spirit here at Lake Cities, and I think you really have to get out. I don't visit many other churches. You really have to get out to appreciate it. And like I say, it's not that it's better, you know, they're worse or any of that. It's just different. It's different to come into a place where you know the people and the people know you, that we can pray for. I'm just so excited for you guys, I can't stand it. That we can pray for things like that, that we can care and love each other. And that's... That has nothing to do with my sermon this morning. I just wanted to tell you, I really appreciate you, and I really love doing this job. Let's look at Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, we're going to start in verse 27. This is such a familiar passage this morning. I want to warn you right now, we're going to camp out in Mark 8, but we're going to look at a lot of different verses this morning. So I want you to be ready to turn, to flip. If you need to write it down, not all of these verses that I'm going to reference are going to be on the screen. So just, I'm not apologizing. I'm just telling you, prepare yourself because we're about to get into it. Mark chapter 8, verse 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "What about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anybody about him. He then began to teach him that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with the disciples, and he said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up the cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him, of them, when he comes in his Father's glory with his holy angels." So, real simple idea this morning, that there's two things that we need to do with this text. We need to answer the question. There's a question that Jesus poses here that we need to answer, that in fact, you need to answer. And it's interesting the way that Jesus poses this question. You see, what I think Jesus is doing here is he's discipling his disciples. He's teaching them. He's bringing them along. He's shaping their theology about what they know about God and what they know about salvation, what they know about Jesus. And so he asks this question, "Who do people say that I am?" And the response is interesting. You see, Jesus is not taking a poll here to see his popularity or gauge what the world thinks about him. This is out of some insecurity that Jesus asked this question. He wants to know what's being said so that he can make a point. And it's an interesting list, isn't it, that the disciples give. And who do they say that the world thinks Jesus might be? Well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, and some say the other prophets, and we look at that and we laugh and we say, those those foolish pagans. How do they not know who Jesus is? But what I found interesting is that all three of those responses, stay with me here, are biblical responses. If you go back to Mark chapter 6, there's a reason why people might have thought that Jesus was John the Baptist. And why was that? Because John the Baptist was dead. If you want to turn back there real quick, in verse 14 it says, King Herod heard about this. He hears about what all the disciples and what Jesus are doing, that they're going around, that they're casting out demons, that they're healing people. And Herod thinks, uh-oh, this is not good. This may be someone who I just had put to death. And he goes on, it says, when King Herod heard about this, for Jesus' name had become well known, some were saying John the Baptist has been raised from the dead, and that's why miraculous powers are at work within him. If you're Herod, if for a minute you can slip into his sandals and wear his crown, that's a problem. If one of your greatest enemies or perceived enemies, you chop their head off and they come back to life, that's a zombie army, folks, okay? I mean, that is bad news for anybody. But if you're somebody who's clinging to power and trying, and you remember what despots and rulers did back then, they tried to put down not just those that were opposing them, but their entire bloodline, okay? We remember that in the days of Moses, that Pharaoh said, we're going to kill all the babies. We remember that when Jesus was born, the same thing happened, right? The murder of the innocents. And the idea was, is that we're going to blot out this bloodline so nobody that can raise up and take power from me. And so some people thought, this is John the Baptist coming back from the dead and King Herod's in trouble. Now other people said, no, I don't think he's John the Baptist. I think he's Elijah. And we're all like, what? Elijah, chariot of fire? You don't remember this story? But look at Malachi. This is an interesting passage. Malachi chapter 4. This is why I say it's a biblical response. See, I will send the prophet Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn their hearts of the parents to their children and the hearts of the children to their parents, or else I will come and strike the land with total destruction. And if you think about it for a minute, Jesus healed like Elijah healed. You know, Elijah brought people back from the dead. Jesus brought people back from the dead. Elijah, you know, had harsh things to say to religious people. Jesus had harsh things to say about religious people. Elijah performed miracles. Jesus performed miracles. It all seems to parallel. And they said, hey, Elijah's got to come back before God's going to, you know, bring order and do. So maybe it's Elijah. Or maybe it's one of the other prophets. Now that's just an interesting kind of like, you know, check all of the above. I'm not really sure. So I'm just going to think that maybe he's. But look at Deuteronomy 17. What does he say? In verse 18, it says, when he takes, I'm sorry, Deuteronomy 17, is this 17, 18? Did I get this right? 18. I will raise up for them a prophet like you among their fellow Israelites, and I will put my words in his mouth. I will tell them everything I command him. I myself will call to account anyone who does not listen to my words, and the prophet speaks in my name. I think I misquoted that. Has anybody found that yet? Are you guys that are checking my work at home? Yeah, you should be. Chapter 18, thank you. Starting in verse 18. I wrote it down. Okay. Yeah. Chapter 18, starting in verse 18. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. Now, if they're saying if the word is that another Moses is going to come, doesn't that sound a little bit like Jesus? Aren't there an awful lot of parallels between Moses and Jesus? And so what I'm saying here is that biblically, these people had pretty good standing to think that maybe he was John the Baptist, or maybe he was Elijah, or maybe he's one of the other prophets. We all know that they're wrong. Jesus then turns the question. And it's not about what other people say. He says, what do you say? And I'd like to tell you that he's asking them a personal question. I would like for him to say that the you in that sentence is you, Cletus. And the you in that sentence is you, Cameron. And the you in that sentence is you, Cody. And you got to all answer that question. But what he really says here is, you people. He says y'all. Jesus says y'all. What do y'all say? And I could only imagine that the apostles at this point get together and they huddle and they're exchanging ideas. I don't think it's John the Baptist. I think the Elijah thing, I don't know. I don't think that's right. I don't think it's one of the other prophets. Who should we say that he is? It's like Family Feud. They're like, Messiah, good answer, good answer, good answer. Go with that, you know? And so Peter steps forward as a spokesman for them. And this is the answer that I believe they come up with. And he says, you're the Christ. In some translations, you'll read the Christ. In some, it'll say the Messiah. It's an interchangeable word there. He says, you are the Christ. You are the anointed one, is what Peter's saying. Now, what's interesting here is that Jesus doesn't deny that. He doesn't say, you guys got it wrong, I'm not the Messiah. But he also does not self-identify. Jesus doesn't say, you're right, I'm the Messiah. Jesus uses some other words here to identify himself. They're interesting, we're going to look at. You know who the people who identify Jesus in the book of Mark are? It's interesting, if you go back to Mark 1, there's two different groups. One is God. One is God, and at Jesus' baptism, he says, this is my son whom I loved, in him I am well pleased. So God identifies Jesus. But then I think along about verse 24, and I'm away from my notes, I don't know, it's somewhere in there. There's a demon-possessed woman, and the demons cry out, what do you want from us, Holy One? Let me get this right. In Mark chapter 1, it says, what do you want from us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are. This is a demon talking. The Holy One of God. You think it's important that we establish who Jesus is? I think it's not just a question. I think it's the question. I think there is no better question than this question. And so in Jeremiah 23, when the disciples say that Jesus is the Messiah, that's a biblical answer too. They're thinking about another person that Jesus might be. In Jeremiah 23, verse 5, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he will be called, the Lord, our righteous Savior. And they're going, Jesus, that's who you are. And they're right and they're wrong, aren't they? Because when Jesus starts to describe who he is, when he starts to self-identify, Peter says, no, never, Lord, that can never happen. And then Jesus rebukes Peter and he says, you need to get behind me because you're thinking through the lens of the world and you're not looking at this with eternal or heavenly eyes. So who does Jesus say that he is? Maybe that's more important than any of these other opinions. Who does Jesus say that he is? I think this is fascinating. Look at verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man, and lights flashed, and alarms went off, and there was a ringing in their ears, and chills ran up and down their spine. And it didn't happen for you, did it? Right? Because the Son of Man, you're thinking Son of God, you're thinking, you know, that's Jesus. Jesus had a bunch of different names. Christ was his last name. That's not true, okay? When Jesus says the Son of Man, there was another biblical image, a different biblical image that came to mind for the disciples. Let's continue reading that. He says, but when the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed. Now here's where Peter and the rest of them gasped. Because you can't have a Messiah. You can't have a kingly ruler who's going to be killed. This doesn't add up. And after 3 days, rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And to Peter, I would say, good luck with that. Because you don't rebuke God. You don't rebuke Jesus. So who is this Son of Man character? There's actually two different ways that Jesus identifies himself as he's talking to the disciples here. The first one is Son of Man. Well, the Son of Man was prophesied about in Daniel chapter 7, also in chapter 10. But I just want you to listen to this description. This is Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 and 14. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. They're thinking, if you're thinking Messiah and Son of Man are interchangeable, I'd say that you're looking at that through the wrong lens. Because for the disciples, for the apostles, when they heard Son of Man, they thought of a different person. And when they heard Messiah, they thought of a different person. And then there's this third thing that Jesus says that he is. He says that I'm going to have to suffer and die and be killed. And here's where it really gets hard. Because now they're thinking of a different place in Scripture. They're thinking about Isaiah 53. And we read that a lot around the communion table. We read that a lot around Easter time or when we want to talk about the crucifixion. And it was a prophecy about a different, in their minds, a different person, different from the Son of Man, different from the Messiah. And now Isaiah 53, the prophet says it this way. It says that he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering, a man of suffering, not the Son of Man, not the Messiah, somebody different. And familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him, and afflicted. Now, that doesn't sound like the description of Daniel, does it? This strong, everlasting dominion, this ruler, this powerful one, that doesn't really sound like a Messiah. And so there was some, excuse my language here, there was some cognitive dissonance going on amongst these apostles. Because they knew something was true, and then they get a new set of facts, and those things don't mesh together. And that's why Peter rebukes Jesus. That's why he says, Jesus, you can't do that. You cannot lay down your life and be Messiah. What's interesting to me is when you take all three of those descriptions, the Messiah, the Son of Man, the suffering servant, who do they all sound like? Who could they all be? There's only one person that within his character and within his life, all of those things fit. And we read it because we know the rest of the story and we have hindsight and we have the rest of the New Testament and we've figured this out over the years. But it was confusing to the disciples. And Jesus says, this is who I am. How can you rule the world, Jesus, and overthrow the government and have a never-ending reign, but also suffer and be rejected and be despised? And what would we say to that? We would say, look at Jesus. Answer the question. So then Jesus makes a turn. And he goes from using this language about other people, what does the world say that I am, and what do you all say that I am, this group of disciples, and then he speaks directly to you and to me. Individually. I want to do a little exercise here. We're going to read this passage, and I just want you to look for the singular pronouns, okay? Anything referring to just one person. And when you do, just kind of hold up a one finger. You don't have to raise your hand or anything. We're not charismatic. But we're just going to just get a finger up, okay? Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. For what good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory and with his holy angels. And so the question then is turned not to what does the world say, or what does your preacher say, or what does your church say, or what does your theology say, or what all these writers say, but what do you say? Answer the question. And Jesus extends an offer, doesn't he? He says, once you've figured out, once you've decided for yourselves who that is, there's an offer here that we have to accept. I love this story of these two kids that fell in love, Rory Bushfield and Sarah Burke. Anybody know who Sarah Burke is? Champion, X Games participant. You guys love the X Games. I know that you do, right? I want to show you just real quick. This will give you an idea of what kind of people Rory and Sarah, what kind of life they lived. So Rory decided he wanted to propose to Sarah. How do you propose to somebody? How do you make a big enough, you know, gesture to somebody who lives their life on the edge? You know what Rory did? He learned to fly a plane. And then he went up to the top of a mountain, and in Kool-Aid, I don't even know how you do this, on the side of the mountain, he wrote, "Will you marry me, Sarah?" Nathan, that was about what you did, right, for Amber? And then he took Sarah up in this plane and flew her, you know, to the peak of this mountain, and she looked down and sees written in Kool-Aid. I guess it'll be biodegradable. I don't know why Kool-Aid. Will you marry me, Sarah? And I love this. This is the offer that Rory extends to Sarah. She goes, I was so excited that I just looked at him and I said, thank you. I love their story. I'll tell you the rest of it here in a minute. There is a proposal that Jesus makes in this passage. And their proposal is, will you come and be my disciple? And I think he uses that word very specifically, very intentionally. Because what I want you to do is I want you to come and I want you to follow me. I want you to learn from me. I want you to know me. And Ray Vanderland, who does great work at kind of decoding for us, for the Jewish traditions of the past. He talks about how rabbis, their followers, their mathetes, the disciples of the rabbis, would follow very closely behind them. And so there came to be known this phrase. I think you've heard me tell you this story before. And the phrase was, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. May you follow so closely to him that his life is all over your life. So the rest of the story about Sarah Burke, she and Rory were married in 2010. In 2012, the X Games, those kind of events, were accepted into the Sochi Olympics. And so Sarah, being like the best at all of this crazy stuff, she was selected for the team. And while practicing one of her runs, she fell and struck her head and died. And the documentary goes on to talk about Rory's life after her. And he made this amazing statement. He talked about, you heard her say, I just think we ought to do something every day that scares us. And so Rory said, how do I honor her life? What do I do in order to live the kind of life that Sarah would want me to live? He says this, this was the beautiful part of our relationship. We got to encourage each other to live as large as we could. I try to live that same life now. After Sarah died, Rory took up base jumping, which you saw him do. That was the big bridge that he was jumping off. And as he jumps off that bridge, it's in Twin Falls, Idaho. It's this gorgeous, huge bridge. As he jumps off this bridge, you know, my stomach is in knots and my heart sank. And then his parachute opens, this beautiful white parachute, and just huge red letters are the words Sarah. And he lives his life going to these crazy places in the world, doing these amazing things, living on the edge, living large. And there's another thing that he does as well. He takes with him Sarah's ashes. And so in places like Thailand and Bali, and even at the top of a Himalayan mountain, he has spread her ashes. And he says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend the rest of my life living large in her memory. And I love that image because I think it closely relates to what Jesus is calling us to. Do you hear the kind of life that he describes? That somehow we're going to take up a cross like his cross. That somehow we're going to take up a life that looks like his life. That we're going to say things to the world like Jesus said to the world. That's the kind of disciple that Jesus calls us to be. And everywhere we go, we're going to spread a little bit of Jesus with us. So blessed this week. I was at literally one of my favorite places in the world, the Inner City Church in Houston, the Impact Church of Christ. I was telling one of our kids, I said, would you believe this is the 19th trip I've made down here? I love this place. And you should be proud, by the way, you should be really proud of our team. If you were on that trip, would you raise your hand? You need to hug, love, thank, ask one of those kids about their trip, because they did an amazing job loving on about, 115 inner city kids. But one of the things that we did on Monday, which really touched my heart, is we went to this place called Liberty Island, which is an adult facility for mentally handicapped people. And so if you can kind of get in your mind, if you can kind of imagine a retirement home, it's similar to that, but not everybody's of retirement age. But it's all for adults who are mentally handicapped, that have nobody, that are indigent, that need somebody to take care of them. And so our job was to go and throw what they call a Jesus party for these folks. And we brought Cheetos and we brought cupcakes and we brought drinks and we sang songs and we sang upbeat songs and, you know, songs like Said I Wasn't Gonna Tell Anybody, and we were just excited to be there with them. And I'll show you some pictures. That's Thomas. Thomas speaks only in headlines. I said, Thomas, how was your day today? He goes, did you hear there were shark attacks in North Carolina? And I said, no, can you tell me about that, Thomas? He said, it said in Entertainment Weekly today that the Grateful Dead are going to retire. And that's how Thomas talked to me the entire time we were there. Keep scrolling through. You can see some of these beautiful faces. Just wonderful pictures. I wish you could have all been there to interact with and love on these people. I want you to meet one guy in particular. Go to that last slide there, Ken. There you go. I want to get his name right. Maddie, tell me if I'm right. Joseph? Is this Joseph? Joseph is an amazing man. They allowed any of the men there that wanted to lead a song to lead a song, and Joseph led two songs, but the one that he led that just absolutely floored me was Just As I Am. I get the feeling that Joseph knew from remembering all six verses and would have sang all six verses had we let him. But he got up and very clearly on pitch, really a beautiful voice. Joseph has Down syndrome. He sang, just as I am without one plea. He got three words out and I literally started to cry. Because all I could think of in that moment was, that song means something different for Joseph than it means for me. That when he says, Jesus loves me just as I am, it means something different than when I sing it. I was just undone. Like, I just sat, I just listened. I just listened and let him minister to me to tell me what it means for Jesus to love somebody just as they are. And I believe that's the question that Jesus is asking. He's saying, who do you say that I am? And if you want to, if you'll accept the offer, I want you to come walk with me and be covered in my dust, and I want your life to look like me. Isn't it amazing that there was no greater reflection for me this week than the power of an awesome God who created the universe than Joseph? That's the offer that Christ extends to us. And so this morning, I would encourage you to answer the question, but accept the offer. If you have a need, if you'd like for us to pray with you, if you'd like to respond to that invitation this morning, would you come as we stand and sing?
Just as I am without